You're looking good. Jonathan just got an awesome face paint job. What do you think?
I like whoosh.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to issue 96 of Hey Kids Comics. This is a very special issue for us. I am Andrew Farmer, your host. With me, as always, is showrunner, site runner, world runner, and heart runner, as well as run runner. Yes! Yes, Cole Houston! Yes,
you're reading my mind.
Yes, thank you, Cole. Cole, the Jedi, Cole Houston, namesake of Network, is of course with us tonight, along with a very special guest. You've heard his dulcet tones on the Rancor Pit, as well as various episodes of this show, including my favorite of all time episode of Hey Kids Comics, Super Sports Balls, All Pro Super Sports Balls.
Oh, wow, yeah, Super Sports
the Super
Balls.
Promo Sports Balls.
Thank you. See, Eddie remembers. Yeah. You can't forget something like that.
Yeah. It's good that you bring that up, Super Promo Sports Balls, because it actually kind of reminds you of the name Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
He's great at tie-backs, this one over here. Yeah, Eddie, yeah. Eddie Funky Cole Medina joins us tonight to discuss our topic, which is, I'm going to let Cole handle the name because he came up with it, and I'm not going to try it. Cole, what's the name of this issue of Hey Kids Comics?
The name of this issue of Hey Kids Comics is Prepubescent, Genetically Altered. Yeah, listen here.
I said
10 times today to other people.
Prepubescent,
genetically altered martial artist animal species.
I was wondering if he was waiting for somebody to run around the other end of the track with a baton and hand it to him there for a second.
Nice.
Right. So the impetus of this episode, the onus of this episode is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and all things surrounding that, from the parodies to the fact that it's itself was sort of a parody. Cole and Eddie have a long-running, long-standing history with this type of thing. I do with the cartoon. I was never really into the comic until much later. But with the softer side of the Turtles, I'm very...
the softer side of Turtles.
I'm very... The inside. I guess that would be the inside of the Turtles.
Kind of the soft-shell turtle.
Right.
That's right.
I'm much more familiar with that than I am the hardcore until much later in my comic book career. So, Cole, what do you got for us on this? You take us on the road here.
What's odd is, like so many people in that day, discovered or kind of got wind of the Turtles after they hit.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And after they really were getting, some proper distribution, some proper publication. And I actually do recall being at a convention one time and somebody showing off proudly their little bitty first edition Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number one.
Really?
And espousing the tale of, what that was all about. And I think by that time, the name was starting to get some recognition.
To make the rounds. Yeah.
And
well, that was back in the day when you had, it's much harder now because of the industry, but back in those days, we had talked when Eddie was on last time on the show about stuff like ash cans and, one-offs and stuff that you could go to Kinko's and get printed, bring them to the show and get some name recognition out of them. It start spreading the word. You really can't do that as easily now as you could then. With the exception of You Are Here, Volume 1.
Yeah,
I worked it in.
But first, You're Here, You Are Here.
Oh, what did I say?
You just said You Are Here, Volume 1.
Y'all are horrible. He lubed it up and worked it in. There you go.
Wow. Speaking of Grandpa Penis.
Well, see, and that's the thing with the first run of the Turtles. They pulled all their money they could possibly muster together to print up the 3,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't even go through like a traditional comic book printer to have it done. What they did was they went to a local guy there in their town whose specialty was printing up the grocery store circulars and like department store stuff.
Yeah.
So that's why the first two or three runs were oversized and they're not comic book sized.
Really?
And that's why apparently that first run, it's got kind of a weird feeling cover. And from what I've heard, I've never actually, you know.
Yeah, the printing process is considerably different. It's a little bit of an off process type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Certainly what you might expect from someone who, you know,
prints circulars.
Yeah, printing circulars.
Yeah.
What's interesting is I would be hard pressed, I think, to ever pinpoint this. But back in the day, there was a magazine, you know, back in the, especially way back before the internet. There was a magazine called Amazing Heroes.
Yep, okay. I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And Amazing Heroes was literally, this was where you went to get your news about all things comics. In fact, I think Amazing Heroes was breaking the story on the demise of X-Men Avengers, or not X-Men Avengers, but JLA Avengers, at the same time that Marvel was claiming a release date.
Yeah.
which, you know, was rather telling in its own right. But the thing about it is, one of the things that Amazing Heroes had, and it wasn't every issue, but a great many issues had they had a little recurring feature called a silly cover.
Okay.
And the silly covers were just, you know, different artists and all different concepts. Like one I recall just off the top of my head was, Alfalfa Flight.
Nice.
So with all of the Alpha Flight members with a giant cow lick.
Uh-huh.
As far as, like, you know, you can imagine Sasquatch with a great big...
That's the only way I imagine Sasquatch.
Right.
I knew about you and that, but...
it's the way I've always imagined Sasquatch.
That goes along with my foot fetish.
Your Bigfoot fetish.
That's exactly it.
But anyway, that one of the silly covers that they did, and at the time it struck me as very much in response to the period where Storm had one of those wonderful lapses of sanity that are popular in comics, and all of a sudden decided she was a mohawk sporting ninja.
Well, yeah,
my favorite of Storm.
Yeah, once you buy the leather jacket, you're into the lifestyle. You can't get out of it.
But yeah, you know, she went. It's out of the blue. Oh, excuse me, I'll be right back, guys. You know, this isn't Jerome Howard running off and having his long curly locks shaved down to his skull cap, and coming back and reinventing himself as Curly Howard. This is Storm, just, you know, disappearing one issue and coming back the next, clad in, this sort of leather, desperately seeking Susan outfit with a mohawk. And it's just like, what the hell? So here was this what I really genuinely do consider kind of the counterpoint to that, was there was a silly cover that... featured, an X-Men-esque group, all of them sporting mohawks.
Nice.
And it was titled Teenage Mutant Ninjas with Mohawks. And I'd be hard-pressed to confirm this, and I would love to know for certain. I think that predates the Turtles.
Uh-oh.
Really think that Teenage Mutant Ninjas with Mohawks may well have inspired the title Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Well, I got one that goes right along with that. When Marvel Age was a big thing, I distinctly remember an ad. It was probably a back cover, but it was a full page ad, and it was just a silhouette of four upright, you know, bipedal elephants holding different samurai weapons. And the title was Adult Thermonuclear Samurai Elephants, which a few years later, it finally got released as a one-shot, but it was released as called Power Pachyderms. And this was after the Turtles made it big. But I could swear, I mean, if I could find that Marvel Age, I could swear that Samurai Elephants, the concept, predated Ninja Turtles also.
But it is also possible, knowing Marvel,
that
somebody, you know,
right,
in the industry had wind of this little bitty indie that no one was ever going to see or care about.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I don't know, the elephant one just smacks too much of a parody or a ripoff of the Turtles rather than vice versa.
Yeah, yeah. But there, I do remember there was four of them silhouetted in this thing, but, you know, I'll have to go look that up.
That's pretty amazing, though. I mean, it's pretty amazing that all of these things came into the popular consciousness at the same time. We don't know what Patient Zero is. You know what I mean? Like, we have no idea where it really started. Did it start with Eastman and Laird's living room, or did it start, you know, in Jim Shooter's office? God, I hope not. You know, so that's pretty cool. It's a pretty cool concept to really think about, you know. I think we've talked about similar things on the show before where all these things start happening at once, and it's either a function of being able to recognize the pattern, you know, of what's in the popular consciousness, or there is a patient zero somewhere for it.
Yes, that's true. And it could be very much a kind of zeitgeist sort of thing as well. Very often you'll see extremely similar things that, you know, at first blush seem like, oh, that's such a ripoff. And the reality is that it is a fairly well-documented fact that occasionally there is this spirit of the day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That everybody captures simultaneously, and you'll see very similar things that came out of nowhere with no foreknowledge of one another.
Right.
I mean, that quite literally happened with researching the wireless radio. Marconi and DeForest were simultaneously working on the problem and simultaneously achieving some success without any knowledge of each other or each other's work.
DeForest Kelly?
No, I was thinking the same.
Sadly, no. He
damn it!
Nor was it Calvert Forrest, a.k.a. Larry Bud Melman.
It wasn't Larry Bud Melman?
It was not Larry Bud Melman. I hate to burst that bubble as well.
Can I go on believing that Larry Bud Melman invented the shortwave radio?
Good night.
We just dated the show somehow. I don't know how we did. Oh, that's awesome.
That is wild.
Hello, I am the inventor of the radio, wireless radio, Larry Bud Melman.
Larry Bud Melman. I think that might be the first Larry Bud Melman reference on Hey Kids Comics ever. And almost 200, and almost 100, wow.
Or any podcast whatsoever.
Yeah,
except for the Larry Bud Melman cast.
Oh, that's true. Larry Bud Melman cast, that's all they talk about.
Yeah, it gets... man. So what is the history of the Turtles? Like we've talked about, like, they've been, you know, we've talked about some of the parody stuff and stuff like that, but, like, how did it start?
Well, Eastman and Laird actually came up with the concept back in 1983. So it took them about a year before they actually, from concept to finished product, to get it out there. But it actually came as, you know, the two of them had already met, and they were already working in this, quote, studio, which was just a shared space. And they had already produced one or two issues of Gooblygook, which was kind of like a sci-fi kind of weird anthology series.
Really?
And and
I did not know that.
No.
Yeah, so Turtles wasn't even their first foray into self-publishing. And so when they were sitting around one evening, they were trying to have a drawing challenge, like, what, who can come up with, you know, different things. And I could be wrong, but I think Eastman was the one that came up with the concept of a bipedal turtle holding ninja weapons. And so Eastman Eastman drew his version, Laird drew his version, and somehow together they came up with the actual name, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And you can see that they have online, you can find the first renditions that they both came up with, which is vastly different than what we knew them. Even from that point to Mirage issue one, they changed drastically. But they immediately came up with the name, and that was, like I said, 1983, and a year later, they worked on it, they pulled their resources, they got their grocery store circular guy to print up the thing for them, and they debuted it May 5th, 1984 at the Portsmouth, New Hampshire MiniCon. So imagine being at, I think it may have even been one of these small one day conventions.
For our New Hampshire listeners, apologies. Andy and I realize that it is Portsmouth.
It is Portsmouth.
Okay,
and,
whatever.
And not only that, but don't worry, your one day MiniCon will show up on Convention Awareness Project Texas next week. So you'll be fine.
Oh, wow. Portsmouth sounds better, though. But anyway, yeah, it was like a
Portsmouth. That's an H.P. Lovecraft nightmare is what that is.
Literally was at a one-day convention at a hotel like a Howard Johnson. So could you imagine, you know, being the person to walk by their table as they're trying to pimp issue one of Ninja Turtles and, like, thinking it's ridiculous, walk by, only to discover later that you just walked by
right.
a potential gold mine, you know, had you just scooped up every copy that they had.
Right.
You know, it's almost like that vinyl.
Oh, well, you know, I think we'd all have, like, you know, retired on X-Men 94s or any number of things like that.
Oh, sure.
Had we the means to travel back in time,
yeah,
which is
exactly.
why time travel has been rendered impossible.
Also, how sad is it?
The guy that ever did it.
How sad is it that the three of us are talking about, if we had the ability to travel in time, what we would do is buy really comic books that would become really expensive. We're not putting, like, stock in Google or Apple. We're like, we're going to buy Spider-Man number 6, and we're going to go from Piggly Wiggly to Piggly Wiggly buying Spider-Man number 6. And then, when it becomes popular, we're going to sell it, just like Biff did.
Or if you were, like, in the moment, you could do like I did and Steve and our friend James and buy up every copy of Web of Spider-Man number 1 you can lay your hands on.
Wow.
So that in your future, it will be worthless.
Yeah, we would go back and instead of, like, you know, taking out Hitler before he could do it, we're going out and buying up every blue Snaggletooth we can find.
Yeah,
right.
And then, you know, you go to the catalog desk and your 26 or 30 creature cantinas are being handed over to you, and you come up a penny short, you reach in, you pull out your 1985 penny, and you look at it, and all of a sudden... weeping openly.
You take out the DVD cover of Phantom Menace.
That was on their own.
You pull out the DVD cover of Phantom Menace, and Jar Jar Binks is slowly fading away on it.
That would be awesome. Oh, man.
What are we talking about? Oh, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the mini-con at Portsmouth.
Portsmouth mini-con at the Hojo.
The Portsmouth! Hey, I've been to some fine conventions at Hojo's, thank you very much.
I can't think of Howard Johnson's without thinking of the movie Top Secret. I'm just going to throw that out there. Omar Sharif, I'm staying at the Howard Johnson's. But at any rate,
but it becomes insanely popular, A, and yeah. and B, it also becomes sort of a benchmark for self-publishing. You know, that it becomes a battle cry for people to create their own comics.
Yeah.
That is so true. And I think, you know, the real question then becomes how and why does it become so popular? Mm-hmm. And I think because it was something so new, something so unusual.
Right.
Yet its strength was it was actually good.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And that is it, you know, not to be too much Jedi Cole, which I can't help, but you know, that's what made Star Wars a phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
I think we're all in agreement with that. Let's not, you know, I mean, we all know that Lucas ripped off everybody from Gilgamesh to Sergio Leone to make his movie, but he did it well, and that's good. That's what makes fans for life, right? That's
exactly.
And as Andy just discovered here recently, Turtles itself was a parody.
Right! Yes! I was talking to Eddie about that. Like, I didn't realize, like, it blew my mind today doing research that the Turtles were, you know, a ripoff of, like, Daredevil and Ronin and Frank Miller's art.
Yeah, it was definitely an answer, and, you know, in much the same way that Teenage Mutant Ninjas with Mohawks It was all about, you know, that period where, yeah, you had Elektra and the hand, you know, ninjas were becoming very popular in the West, and everybody was a freaking ninja.
Yeah.
I mean, everywhere you turned. I mean, you know, back when Catherine and I were dating, this her roommate's boyfriend, her roommate and her roommate's boyfriend had got adopted a little kitten. It was a little black kitten. And, of course, what did they name it? They named it Ninja. And it's just, you know, I was just wanted to vomit a little because I was just sick to death of ninjas.
Well, you can thank Michael Dudikoff for that. You know,
American, I thank Michael Dudikoff every day of my life.
Oh man!
No, but like the Logan, like Wolverine's a ninja now. Like what? What? Why? Why? Like everybody's a ninja. Like no.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and Wolverine had his ninja phase. It was sort of like the, you know, George O'Keefe, you know, having a blue period. Everybody had a black period for some reason.
I thought you were going to say George O'Keefe had a ninja period.
Versus that would be great.
He actually did have a ninja period. It's less did published.
I'm going to draw this. I'm.
She was the Elektra of the art world, I suppose.
I'm gonna draw this flower that looks like a vagina that looks like a ninja.
Well, a lot of people, you know, there is that kit that grows in.
This is the greatest show I've ever recorded.
In fact, that's my
mental,
new
the mental image alone.
Is ninja vagina.
Have you met my master, Ninja Vagina Orchid?
Oh my god.
House of the Ninja Vagina Orchid. It is an awkward name for a ninja.
It's just, it rolls off the tongue. No.
Nice.
Oh. But we're talking about turtles. We're talking about the fact that they named their clan the Foot Clan because the hand. And
the hand, exactly.
I know, and that's the other thing Andy and I were talking about earlier. Is he was saying he didn't put two and two together that the foot was a takeoff of the hand, and I was telling him, well, I was a Turtles fan before a Daredevil fan. So to me, when I first started reading Daredevil and I saw the hand, I thought, oh my gosh, they ripped off.
What a ripoff.
I know, well, exactly.
You know what's funny is I knew what little I knew about the Turtles as their star was rising. I was aware of the Foot Clan and I got that joke, but I never really connected the whole thing. Oddly enough, that directly to the ninja craze, even though it was so blatantly part of the ninja craze. I guess because I was stuck more on that whole Teenage Mutant Ninjas with Mohawks thing.
Right.
Well, you know, it gets out there. They get proper publication. They get proper distribution.
Yeah.
Because this thing, you know, those 3,000 copies were suddenly spun gold.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the first regular proper issue comes out. And was it the first one like a reprint or was?
Go ahead, Daddy. I'm sorry.
The first regular issue, was it a reprint of the first self-published or?
No. It was just its own thing. Like they just continued.
Okay,
like,
if you weren't one of the lucky 3,000, you're just shit out of luck.
Well, they ran they ran a second printing.
Okay, that's true.
To date, at least on the Mirage part of it, I don't know what IDW has done, but Mirage ended up doing 5 print runs. It went from 3,000 to 6, then from 6 to 35, and so it just kept growing. With every print run, it kept growing more and more. I got in on it pretty early, and that's the thing. I was so young, it wasn't like I was into comics to jump on the next craze or to invest into like the next big hit. I was into, at the time, even though I was a fan of Spider-Man and Batman because of the cartoons and shows, the comics I collected were G.I. Joe, Star Wars, and Indiana Jones. So I was always looking for those. I wasn't into capes and all that. I was looking for anything that was interesting that would catch my attention. So when I heard about Turtles...
And cape-free.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I think I first heard about the Turtles, oddly enough, in a... You know how you, back in the day when you had to order your comics through an actual catalog.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was American Comics. When I got their newest catalog, I saw this teeny tiny little blurb about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And, you know, they had a tiny little black and white image of a turtle face. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So I went to of all places, Bill's Books, and here in Duncanville, Texas.
Wow, and Bill's Books.
Yeah, you know Bill. You know Bill well. And so I went there looking because I heard, you know, because of this catalog said it was on the third printing. So I was going in to look for the third printing, and he was saying, oh, we're sold out of the third printing, but we just got in the fourth printing. So I was in on it from the first issue, and I'll tell you what, when I read that first issue, I was used to things on the little level of G.I. Joe, mind you. So to read something in my mind at that age was so in-your-face, violent, and brutal, and gritty. Mm-hmm.
It was very sophisticated because what it told was essentially a really good story.
Yes.
That the protagonist just happened to be somebody's pet turtles that got flushed down the into the sewer that happened to be full of some sort of radioactive slime or something that
Daredevil. Was the, what?
Yeah. That was the precursor to Smallville's kryptonite.
That's right.
And that you could just do, you know, whatever you needed. That's what it does.
Yeah.
Because apparently kryptonite on Smallville was like Dial H for Hero.
So, does anybody know? And this is a legitimate question. I'm not being like a gadfly here. Does anybody know how Splinter learned ninjutsu?
All the arts of ninjutsu. He was and Eddie will back me up on this, I hope, or at least let me know how wrong I am. If I recall, he was the pet rat of a ninja master.
Yeah, Hamato Yoshi.
And as rats are often wont to do, they're like the taskmaster of the mammal family.
Right, they have photographic reflexes.
Exactly.
They watch. They're like the velociraptor. They learn.
Clever rat.
Yeah, they do. So, you know, people with rats are probably, that's what they do.
That's pretty much it. That's how it works in the rat world.
Stephen King had a pet rat for a while. He actually started writing rat novels before he had to have it put down.
Well, that's how it is with every rodent. That's why you got jujitsu gerbils and
It's a trait of
black belt hamsters and Miami mice and hamster vice.
Miami mice.
Fantastic.
First.
So let me ask this, okay? What is your favorite thing? What drew you, aside from like, okay, so the story's good. There's a lot of good stories. There's a lot of good comics out there. We do a show every week about good comics and bad comics. What drew you to Teenage Mutant Ninja, mostly bad comics? What drew you to the Turtles? Like, why did you say, I want to stick with this idea, I want to run with the Turtles for a while?
Yeah, I'm guessing it wasn't just a fondness for, like, reptiles.
No, it was two things. It was the design of the characters and the style of the art, basically, that captured my attention. The second was, that was the first time I had ever purchased a black and white comic.
Oh.
So.
Mystique.
Yeah, to see that. To see that unfold in a black and white thing like that with the different tones and everything was, in my mind, as somebody who was already trying to learn the tricks of the trade, was just amazing. And so I immediately went back to school copying the Eastman and Laird style. I would draw all the... I mean, Colleen can back me up because she remembers I was drawing turtles for everybody through high school and everything. I would draw them, but I would draw them in the Eastman and Laird style as opposed to the cartoon style once that became popular. Everybody wanted the cartoon style. I would draw it during class, give it to them. They're like, that's not the cartoon style. I was like, man, that's the real turtle.
I thought it's more like, that's not even a Teenage Mutant.
I know, exactly. I think it was mostly the look, first and foremost. But yeah.
Okay, well, that's cool. As an aspiring artist, that's what drew you in.
I remember that, you know, very soon after getting wind of the Turtles, there was definitely, you know, they captured somebody's imagination pretty pronto.
Yeah.
And then made their entree into television. And I knew enough about the comic book Turtles to know that the cartoon and the toys and everything was a very very toned down.
Oh, yeah.
In much the way you would hear about how, like, you know, people who were either familiar with or just really pretentious and made themselves overly familiar with the source of things like Battle of the Planets or Speed Racer and stuff, would either proudly or smugly tell you that, well, you know, you realize, of course, there's all these intrigues and she's having an affair with, you know, her husband on the actual show in Japanese, and little kids don't really watch this. It's more young adults and adults and such.
Well, it loses something in the translation,
it's like thing where it was boiled down to its constituent things, homogenized sweetened up and turned into something friendly, because a lot of people don't realize the original Powerpuff Girls,
they were all
like 17-year-olds. It was a whole different kind of story. Yeah, the dad, the scientist, had really genetically engineered them as pleasure models.
Oh, here we go. Think about what you're laughing at. All right, that's all I'm saying. You know what was the most? You know what was the coolest thing that I learned that had nothing really to do with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
What's that?
Was that when they went to Great Britain? They had to be called the Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles.
Yes.
Michelangelo wasn't able to have nunchucks. He had to have a grappling hook. Do you know why?
I don't know why.
Here is why. Because of the fact that in Great Britain, now again, this is like Cole's just talking about, but this is, I'm thoroughly enamored by this.
You realize, of course, that over in the States, the Yanks gave him a pair of nunchucks.
Nunchucks.
That's awesome.
Because anything that featured nunchucks was like an 18 plus rating, like a rated R rating.
Oh wow!
At the time period, yeah. So they had to
Enter the Dragon was
right. Like I was fully amazed by that fact. I did not know that.
Did not know that. Yes.
So I was
changed the name, but I didn't realize that they changed his weapon and why they had to change his weapons.
Yeah, because it's too adult. Apparently, that's what you get for living in a gunless society over there. Nunchucks become your most dreaded weapon.
Well,
can't go into a Starbucks.
A grappling hook and not a walkie-talkie.
Right.
Oh gosh. But you know, as with anything, whether it be comics, movies, fashion, once you get something that's a hit, then all of a sudden, overnight, everybody has to put out their version of it.
Right.
And the 80s explosion of the mutant critter craze, black and white critter craze, was beautiful and frightening at the same time.
It was perfect.
Yeah, in so many ways, what Eastman and Laird did, the unexpected consequence, was they made the indie publisher viable.
Right.
And the distributor stood up and took notice.
Oh yeah.
And I think it opened a door for, you know, something that no one ever really expected was going to happen, is all of a sudden this little bitty indie is amazing. So it becomes like, well, we don't want to miss out on the next
Star Wars.
We don't want to miss out on the next Turtles or the next the damn purple dinosaur?
Barney.
The next Barney. Yeah, you know, nobody wants to miss out on the next fill in the blank. So what happens is a flood, an inevitable deluge of the next.
The bubble. Yeah. The indie bubble was created. That,
you know, the next whatever is going to be nothing. Mm-hmm, remotely like that.
Well, the next whatever is going to be a good... Here's the problem, and we've talked about this so many times on the show, is it's not the next black and white indie comic about anthropomorphic animals. It's the next good independent comic book is what you should be looking for, and nobody's doing that. They're trying to ride the wave.
Yeah, and you're right, Cole. Like, prior to Ninja Turtles, you had some indie books like ElfQuest, and I think it was called
ElfQuest.
Yeah, they were making a name for themselves, but it wasn't like that phenomenon where all of a sudden everybody had to get their hands on it, and every publisher had to put out, you know their thing. You know, like was it Blackthorn Publishing was one of the biggest culprits. Not only were they trying to tackle all the different martial art critter things, but they started putting out one of my favorites, who actually enjoy this comic, is Alien Ducklings. And then they put out, and then you had stuff like I said earlier, Hamster Vice and Miami Mice. And
but you know, even beyond the parodies and stuff, you got a lot of just the, it was just indies a go go.
Well, when did does anybody know whether Poison Elves came out before or after?
Poison Elves would have come out during the boom.
Okay.
But, you know, it's a good point to bring up ElfQuest, because ElfQuest had already carved out its niche long before the Turtles came to the
scene. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And there were a few viable indies, but there weren't that many. And, you know, you really had to have already made a name for yourself to literally have a shot at making a name for yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, your distribution avenues were limited at best.
Yeah.
And even then, a lot of stuff, you know, if you wanted your crap to sell, you pretty much put out a little bitty tiny ad in like the, what was the name of that?
Comic Buyer's Guide.
Comic Buyer's Guide, yeah, the big tabloid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was just chock full of ads. And sometimes one would kind of pique your interest. And there were a couple that did that. Or you just got lucky and some writer for Amazing Heroes or one of these other magazines would take notice.
Right.
And, you know, do a little write-up or say, you know, you ought to find this.
Yeah.
But
and often, more often than not, it was like, it was books like that weren't a ripoff of Turtles. It was books like Albedo, or Albedo, however you pronounce it, where they were animals, but there was substance to it. Or like Cole, like with Omaha the Cat Dancer.
You had these books that
told good stories.
And in the case of both of those titles, Albedo, and I was kind of, actually, that had crossed my mind, that particular title, because I was sort of curious about whether or not, you know, chronologically, where does Albedo fall?
Yeah, I'm not sure myself, but I it was either about the same time, maybe slightly prior, but it definitely...
It certainly benefited. You know,
yes.
One benefited greatly from the other.
And the, isn't that what gave birth to Usagi Yojimbo?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe so. With Flaming Carrot and all of that, and coming in tow of that, I believe.
Yeah, Flaming Carrot had been around because Bob Burton's baby had enjoyed some strange moderate success for just being weird.
Right.
And if you've ever met Bob Burton in real life, he's actually stranger than his wife.
Stranger than fiction.
Yes, he is. But he is a bizarre and strangely fascinating man. You become mesmerized. It's like the... Oh, Benicio del Toro is the collector.
You can't look away.
I love that. I love the correlation there.
Yeah, he really is. You're just, you are lost in
that
this.
That is dead on perfect.
You're trapped. You are trapped.
You are completely captivated by this man. And and luckily someone else comes behind you with a big old stack of Flaming Carrot and you know, demands you get out of the way, and that saves you, so then they can have a taste.
So you can break eye contact long enough his cobra, Khan the Cobra, slowly hypnotizing you into joining his cult.
Oh my gosh. Oh, wow.
So they, you know, you did get, it's hard to pinpoint, you know, which chickens came before which eggs, but you can definitely pinpoint the ones that followed. And, you know, we definitely want to give some coverage to the titles that...
Yes.
Benefited from this period or part of this sudden boom in the black and white indies. But what we really need to talk about is it a parody or is it a ripoff? Are we trying to ride the turtle coattails? Are we just doing a friendly parody? And as such... Riding the turtle coattails.
Right. Isn't 601 about half dozen of another when you're discussing this?
Some of them genuinely were, you know, a lot of them were just one shots. And I think some of them, they really thought they were going to
make it
go toe to toe.
Right. They're going to make it. They got this idea that's better than the turtles.
All of the titles tended to have a group of four.
Yep.
They tended to have some, you know, underlying theme. And admittedly, at the time, I was working on my own little indie comic called Stripes the Cat, which was intended to parody, like, everything in comics. And I had actually worked out, I wish I could, honestly wish I could remember the exact name, but they were like these martial artist earthworms.
Ah!
I thought if you're going to go for a parody, go so extreme that, you know, go with an invertebrate that has no means of visualizing anything.
Right.
In a way, it comes like that Hitachi, not Hitachi, but the swordsman.
Zatachi?
Oh, yeah, Zatachi. I say
Hibachi. Hibachi. Karachi? No, that's a country. There's a city. That's a city, not a country.
I thought Karachi was like a kaiju, like a giant monster.
It could be. It could be. Like, but wait, Eddie, while you're drawing Grandpa Penis, draw Karachi, not Karachi, but Karachi the kaiju. Just one giant crotch with arms and legs. That's all it is. It's like MODOK, but instead of a face, it's just a wang.
It's just an area. Okay.
Giant area. Call it his bathing suit area. Just that's all it is. Like,
but, you know, I don't want to know what his special power is.
One thing that struck me about the Turtles, though, really was the fact that Eastman and Laird chose the names brilliantly. Uh-huh. And they invoked the names of the Hall of Famer classical artists. And either by accident or design, for the most part, they were you were able to abbreviate those names into nicknames.
Mm-hmm. Right. Roth, Leo.
Leo. And Don. And the other one.
The other one. Ringo.
Ringo. Ringo. So, you know, I followed suit and named mine after abstract impressionists.
But, Dagon, Dali, and...
Yeah, but it doesn't matter now, because that became... mine was like Fox Force 5. It became nothing. So, let's get to those that became at least something, if only a flash in the pan.
Right.
Definitely want to give a shout out to my good friend George Makis, because he was the writer and creator of mildly microwaved prepubescent Kung Fu Gophers.
Was he?
Yes.
That is amazing, because I remember mildly microwaved prepubescent Kung Fu
Gophers. I had it. And let me tell you, this
the
is
postpubescent in the name of this issue is inspired by that.
By the prepubescence of these gophers.
See, there you go, George. If you're listening, you're still inspiring people.
You're important, man. You're doing important work.
Well, see, and this is the thing. I had Kung Fu Gophers in my collection along with, you know, Cyborg Turtles and Nat Rat and everything else. But
yeah, and you didn't have it just solely in case he dropped by, right?
No. And
that's like a pillow your mom gives you.
I had it. Yeah, I had it. It came out like in 1986, and I had it that long. And I'll tell you what, George, I hadn't met him in person, but I knew him through Yahoo groups because we were both part of the Christian Comic Yahoo group. And at the time, this was when I was just getting into self-publishing myself. I had just put out my first comic book. It was called Stick to the Shadows, and it was a superhero ninja-type comic book. And
I knew it! It was everything was ninjas back then!
Yep.
Exactly.
Everything was ninja.
How old were you, Eddie, when you did this?
And so this was...
Oh, he just ignored my question. Don't dodge my question! How old were you when you put this out?
What did you say?
How old were you when you put this out?
Oh, this was in 2002, so I was already teaching at this point.
You were a grown-ass man putting out a ninja comic.
I was, and I will still put one out today. This was 2002. I had never done a convention ever. George contacted me saying he was flying in from Chicago, and him and some other guys were going to set up at Dallas Comic Con if I wanted to share their booth. It was going to be two tables. And he goes, because I know you just put out your comic. I was like, oh, yeah, sure. So George is the one who actually brought me into the whole Artist Alley convention scene.
Wow.
So actually, what made it possible for me to actually start back in 2002 to get my first taste of what it was to set up at a convention. And, of course, from there, it just took off. I never stopped doing it at that point.
Wow, that's awesome. So
I show up, okay, Thursday night. We meet up at a Whataburger, and we start talking. And somehow we start talking about, you know, my favorite comics, and I said Ninja Turtles. And he goes, oh, were you into the whole, you know, mutant critter craze? I was like, oh, of course I was. I still have owned most of mine. He goes, do you happen to own Kung Fu Gophers? I was like, yeah, yellow cover with the four gophers wearing the blue geese. He goes, I wrote and created that.
He was probably amazed that you...
Yes, but that's because I was a
your
real
recall.
Fan of it. I was a true fan of that comic. And he said, you know,
who was not?
Yeah. Hey, mind you, this is in 2002. This was well beyond me getting out of that craze, but I still had that comic. So he goes, I created that. My jaw dropped. So, wow. Like the big fanboy that I was, I show up the next day, first day of the convention with all my... I set up with the guys, we get ready. Before the doors open, I bring my copy to George to get autographed.
Aww. I'm sure he was thrilled.
He was. He was pretty impressed that I had it. But anyway, I had that, and everything else that came out at the time, the Cold-Blooded Chameleon Commandos, the Kung Fu Kangaroos... I had it all. And of course...
You can't just do that. You have to say the full name.
Yeah, you can't just... You can't...
You don't come in here and drop a charge and leave, old man.
Okay.
you like matching, Mr. Lawrence?
Kangaroos.
Which, oddly enough... Dirty Gene Kung Fu Kangaroos. Absolutely.
Which, oddly enough, actually, in the first issue, they had a legitimate authorized cameo of the Ninja Turtles in, like, two or three panels. And it was... drawn by Eastman, I believe. They gave him the pages already mapped out, and he drew in whichever turtle it was. Yeah. So,
In fact, the turtles got around a bit as well. They invaded, did they invade Cerebus?
Yes. Or Cerebus invaded them.
Yeah. One way or the other. Because Cerebus, is one of those interesting points like ElfQuest. Cerebus was like the successful black and white indie.
Mm-hmm.
When there were no successful black and white indies.
And Canadian.
Well. Also.
Aardvark, which was actually spawned, as the story goes, from a misspelling of the dog of Hades, Cerberus.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Where does Jeff Smith...
example of where does this crap come from? And it's usually some really stupid thing, but who cares?
Yeah. Where does Jeff Smith's bone... fall into this category?
That came later in the 90s, I believe.
And I really appreciate nobody jumping on the potential for a joke there. But yeah, I think Bone came...
We all give it too much reverence, I think. We all...
Yeah, we actually have a lot of respect for Jeff Smith.
It says 1991 here is when it debuted.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was a late comer. But Bone was really more obviously inspired by Pogo.
Right, absolutely.
Has that wonderful sense of just, you know, this strange, silly, fun world, and it's all about the fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, certainly Bone benefited from these Pathfinders.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm talking about... go ahead.
No, I think that so many things that we've seen have benefited from the Pathfinders. Not only, you know, your independent books... but writers and artists that have gotten into the industry since, and it opened up the industry more to less of an old boys club. Obviously, we know that it's not that, but it gave you the ability. It gave you the ability to take your portfolio to a convention and say, hey, if Eastman and Laird can put out a book, look at my Batman, you know, and people, it gave people a little more grew them a pair, you know, and people would go out.
It opened a lot of doors. It made people realize that there was viability.
Yeah.
You know, it really comes down to, you know, capturing in a sense lightning in a bottle sometimes, and they certainly did that. But they could just as easily, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles could just as easily have just disappeared. I remember going to a convention one time when these guys were really touting this book that it, you know, I never pursued it, but it was fairly obvious that, you know, this was their self-published book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called The Clock, and it had a really cool cover with this, you know, Grim Reaper-looking character. And I was kind of intrigued. I can find no evidence of existence. of comics that I remember.
Oh, man, there are so many books that... Okay, I'm going to put this on the table now. I want to do an entire episode, and Eddie, you're more than welcome to come back, because I guarantee you that you're going to be as big a part of this as we are.
Yes.
Called, I want to do an episode of what I'm calling Comic Book Roanokes. Books that you know went out there.
I had like six of them just pop into my head just
and now they are gone.
We do have an upcoming episode called House of Obscurity.
Right. It might be a good...
That this is even a different take on that, to go even further obscure.
Right. Because how many...
existed, like Heroes, which was a black and white title that ran a few issues.
Uh-huh.
I used to have a promotional poster for it.
I mean, I could go right now, like Eddie said during his... during the promotional and the ash cans and stuff like that. I know there's a book called, oh man, now I gotta remember, Solar Man that Marvel put out. Not Solar Man, what was it called? Crap, see, this is the whole thing.
I know what you're talking about.
He looked like a Thundercat, but not a cat, but and then had like Firestorm hair. And I can picture it in my head.
I know what you're talking about, too.
Right. So, Roanoke books. I want to do an entire show on Roanoke books. Books that you know happened, but all civilization has forgotten. They got dark cityed out of existence.
I'm saving mine, because I literally am like thinking right now of like so many titles I could talk about. I'm saving them.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we will have to. We should just do a back-to-back. The House of Obscurity and the Roanoke books.
I'm with it. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do that.
And you know, you were talking about how the turtles would get around. Here's another one. I had this in my collection too. They were popping up in these little cameo books and other black and white independents. They made appearances in, of all places, The Last of the Viking Heroes.
Really?
Wow. Yes. Actually that happened a few Roanoke times. Books. That actually happened a few times, and I remember being really disappointed because I was finally able to track down one of the issues that came out with the Turtles, and of course, on the cover is this big hulking Ninja Turtle, and I noticed, like, why does he have fangs? And what it was, if I remember the story correctly, this turtle got transported back into the Viking era, but when he came through more monstrous, and he had, like, fangs, and he was more of like a... I think he acted more of like a creature demon
sort
type thing.
Sort of like a Grendel mutant.
No, God.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, as we wrap up, because we're coming up against it already.
Damn it, so much to cover.
I know.
Let me throw a few out here.
Yeah, please.
Some titles that I think either came about this period or... because it was so hit and miss. There were so darn many. There were the bad parody titles. We talked earlier about Marvel having the power pachyderms.
Yeah.
What started out as adult thermonuclear samurai elephants. There was adolescent radioactive black belt hamsters. And the title that Eddie and I, and I think Andrew, were mentioning that we remember this X-Mutants. And I always thought that was they were trying to, you know, rip off X-Men. They were originally X-Mutant Teenage Samurai Humans, and then they just shortened that to X-Mutants.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some fun things, because the other thing that this did was spark the parody boom. And there were great titles, and there were god-awful titles. There was like Spidery Mon. Redlock Jamaican Spider-Man.
Where's Stu when you need him?
I know. He'd be like, hey, man, how many titles you got?
Okay. How many titles you got, Mom?
Cole, you'll remember this one. Do you remember the Rambo ripoff Gorilla Groundhog?
Yes, I remember that.
You remember
Are
that?
You kidding me?
Vaguely, yes. And then, of course, we mentioned, I think, maybe Samurai Penguin.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh,
it's so much a parody book, but it was, you know, the anthropomorphics took off as well. And then there was just the terribly, terribly awful Daffy Cadaffy.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that.
You too.
In fact, there was a great parody that published several different books, but the very first one was brilliant because it was one of the best parodies of a book where you could tell the parody was paying attention to the book in the way Mad Magazine or Cracked would pay attention to whatever they were parodying.
Right.
And what they were parodying was Frank Miller's The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
And how it arrived to you was Nat Rat the Dark Nat Return. And it was cartoony, but very much trying to invoke that gritty look of The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
And there were brilliant things like, you know, his sidekick, Tadpole. This chick was trying to be the new Tadpole. And there's the scene where, like, the new Robin in The Dark Knight is doing, like, a backflip off of the top of a building and landing on her feet and saying, "Didn't suck." And their answer to this, which, I mean, it was I loved it because I just was fresh off The Dark Knight, is here's Tadpole trying to do the same and falling.
It just,
sucked.
Yeah. Exactly.
And there were all these things. And then that was followed with Happy Birthday, Nat Rat, which was a brilliant parody of, like, Batman. It was like a Batman annual or a Batman special or Batman 150, 250, 350, whatever it was. There was a big special issue of Batman or Detective, one of the two, that was illustrated by Bill Sienkiewicz. Or Sienkiewicz, as we used to call him.
Sienkiewicz.
Yes, till I think somebody at Marvel told me what his name was pronounced like. And they did, again, very brilliant parody of that. And then as a creator, it kind of faltered when they did Nat Rat the movie.
Oh, I remember that.
Because for some reason, one of the big plot elements was the John Holmes Tower. Which I seemed a little out of place, but there were some other things. Like, I remember diligently, Comics Buyer's Guide, for tipping me off to Fish Police.
I remember Fish Police.
Yes, and if you've ever seen the very short-lived Hanna-Barbera cartoon of the same name, they bought the rights, they used the name, and the character names, and flush the rest of it down the toilet, and gave you something that it was fun, but it should have been flushed down the toilet.
Right. But
I had got my hands on, like, second and third issue of Fish Police, and bear in mind, this is pre-internet. I was going through the guide of comic shops and calling all over the nation to track down a copy of Fish Police number one at a price I was willing to pay, which turned out to be $15.
Wow.
And another title that benefited greatly from the indie boom and was well worth the effort of picking up was, of course, Ben Edlund's seminal epic, The Tick.
Oh, yes. If it wouldn't have been for... the black and white indies, I don't know if The Tick would have been able to exist in the form and fashion that it did.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember how The Tick came about?
The Tick, as the story goes, was the result of a friendly football game in which there was, amongst people, the Tick actually came from NEC, which was New England Comics.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Yeah,
the comic shop had actually, Ben Edlund was a friend of, like, the son of the owner or something like that. Yeah. But the actual character of the Tick came out of a football game where there was this one guy that nobody could stop.
Right.
Like, four guys would pile on him, and he would just sort of walk them all to the goal.
And he had no idea.
Yeah, and they said, you know, this guy's like a tick. You can't crush him.
Nice. That makes total sense.
Through the first rough sketch of the Tick, and then they're like, you know, we're thinking about starting a publishing arm. Let's develop this. And Ben Edlund proved he wasn't just a great writer. He was a brilliantly funny man.
Yeah.
And when the Tick spawned a cartoon, and when the Tick spawned a television show, you could always tell Ben Edlund's presence because nobody understood that character the way he did. And when he left the comic, you could tell. When he left the cartoon, you could tell because nobody got it the way he did.
So, I got one question for Eddie. Okay. And my favorite of these, the anthropomorphizing animal craze, was a toy line that had an accompanying comic book. That would have been the Barnyard Commandos.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My brother and I used to get on full-on fist fights over some Barnyard Commandos. But, Eddie, are there any...
You know, interesting point about the Barnyard Commandos, those were the sheep that were never nervous.
That's right.
The farmers were nervous.
Nice.
The shepherds were nervous.
Wow.
Eddie, were there any Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle promo comics?
Yeah, actually, I do have some in my collection.
Pizza and Hut.
No, well, probably so, but no, these are actually pretty hard to come by. These are like mini comics that were given away in the serials, and there's three of them, but I only have two copies of
sort
one
of
each.
A serial, huh, Fred?
Exactly, exactly.
Wow, exactly. Well played.
There are little promo comics, but I gotta say, out of all this craze, the one comic that sprung up that I became a and to this day, I'm still a diehard fan. I weep that this comic is not still in existence. Is a comic that geniusly just made fun of the whole mutant critter craze, and that was Boris the Bear. Which was either Dark Horse Comics, either their first publication or their second publication, but it was right there at the cusp of Dark Horse becoming a publishing entity. And Boris, basically, in his first issue, takes an Uzi and a samurai sword and massacres not just the Ninja Turtles, but every single mutant critter that was.
I remember that. I remember that vividly now. Yep.
But where it was genius is after it did that, every issue that followed that parodied something else. Like there was the Bat Bear issue. There was the Rocket Bear.
Right.
He did a parody of the Rocketeer, the Punisher, everything. But where it took a different turn is it as it was under Dark Horse, each issue was a different parody. But once James Dean Smith took it under his own label, Boris the Bear actually got really good because then he started telling more interesting, more personal stories with Boris the Bear. And I actually thought that's where the best stories came was from later on. But by that time, everybody gave up on it except me, apparently.
Yes, apparently.
But yeah. And real quick, I know we got to wrap this up, but you were talking about Nat Rat earlier, Cole. It's kind of funny how all that came full circle because Mark Martin did that obviously because of the whole black and white craze. And later on, Mirage Studios brought Mark Martin on to do a few issues of Ninja Turtles. And even beyond that, in true form to his Nat Rat roots, Mark Martin wrote and drew the parody for Mirage Studios, the parody to the Ninja Turtles movie, which was the green gray sponge suit sushi turtles. Which he geniusly parodied the first Ninja Turtle movie in that comic book. It is genius.
That's great. That is absolutely great.
And I also want to point out on the subject of the turtles themselves, there was a Donatello, if I remember correctly, special. That speaking of jumping on a craze bandwagon, at the time, the big, because we don't get a lot of controversy in comics a lot of the time.
At least we didn't.
At least back then. But the big controversy going around was Jack Kirby trying to get his original art back from Marvel.
Yeah.
And everybody and their grandmother was coming out because we didn't have the internet where you could just put up meaningless memes and stuff. They were just like putting up Cartoonists and Comic Buyer's Guide. Everybody was jumping on the bandwagon in some way or another. Yeah. And the Donatello special was basically a tribute to Jack Kirby where you had a character who was like an artist or cartoonist, Jack, who not different Jack, of course, but he was befriended by Donatello, and they were very much trying to invoke his style. And finally, you know, before we go, I want to give a shout out to an important anthropomorphic book that isn't Omaha the Cat Dancer.
Oh, okay.
Highly recommend it if you have the capacity to enjoy the only really good, sophisticated book to come out of the Dirty Book adult, the Dirty Book black and white indie craze. And that is Jim Strom's incomparable The Serial Killings, which I have yet is C-E-R-E-A-L.
Right.
And what's brilliant about it is it's all of these intrigues at a cereal company that's run by the mascots of the various cereals.
Oh, that's amazing. That's super cool.
Yeah, so like Snip the Elf, whose brothers apparently passed away some years ago, is the CEO. There is an elephant, a clown, a monkey, a chipmunk characters. And there's human characters as well.
That's weird.
Just what makes it, well, because it kind of invokes the kids. Like, one of the characters is obviously meant to be one of the kids that used to hang around with that pervert Captain Crunch.
What? That's awesome!
Oh, think man. About it.
Yeah, because he always has those two kids, right? Those
yeah,
two kids.
Exactly. Which he has, who he has shanghaied off to the high seas where no man. One will ever catch him.
Oh, man.
But, you know, this guy's obviously meant to be the adult boy from Captain Crunch.
Uh-huh.
Now working for the cereal company. And there, you know, there's all these little crimes and intrigues and the back history, like, you know, how this Diggum Frog character beast because all he would ever eat was his own cereal. And
wow,
you know, that's awesome.
Great, they called him Doug, and there's a great scene where, you know, they're talking about he ate like some giant tonnage of smelts of fish. They're like, hey, Dougie, how was them smelts? I dug them, D-O-U-G.
Nice.
And it was just like, oh, my God. I don't have all of the issues. I've been trying to every now and again look for them and bring them all together. But the ones I have tell this amazing, bizarre, fun story that is just, it's replete with you. You get a feel for what the cereal industry must be like.
Right.
It, you know, obviously very heavily researched sort of thing, but I highly recommend if you can find that, track down The Serial Killings. If you can't, a much easier find is Jim Strom's The Golem's Mighty Swing.
I gotta get The Serial Killings.
Right, so do I.
I mean, seriously, I've got to find that.
All right. It's time to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We ran long, but
hey, it's a good show to run long on. What's coming up next week, Cole?
Next week we're gonna give ourselves a little bit of a Andrew and I have just been going gangbusters.
Yeah.
We covered our first story arc a second time.
Right.
So take that, Beatles, and you're not a second time. we have covered women who are into comics. We have covered the barely touched the tip of the iceberg of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles
right.
Interception craze. We have just been going like crazy on all kinds of big topics, so we're going to take it a little bit easier, and we're going to retire to the library. We invite you to please check your nunchucks at the door.
Nunchucks.
And join us for a sniff of brandy as we invite you from the second time, again, take that, Beatles, to enjoy our suggestions of recommended reading.
Recommended reading. BBC's Channel 4. Recommended reading.
Wow.
Tonight on BBC Three, recommended reading with Hey Kids Comics. Andrew Farmer and Cole Houston will
he's a really good impression.
The virtues of some of their favorite comics and graphic novels, and recommend that you yourself check them out, read, enjoy, and above all, collect comics. Oh, bloody hell, we got that in the wrong order.
That's awesome.
Drop your voice only about a quarter of an octave, and then say they walk single file to hide their numbers, and I guarantee you, you're dead on.
Andrew walk single file to hide the numbers.
All right, so awesome. Thank you for that. Erudite.
Trained. You can do the octave off the top of your head. I have to like work my word.
You have to step down.
That's right.
So thank you for that very erudite explanation of what we're going to be doing next week, Eddie.
Yes.
Plug it up, will you?
Well, first and foremost, if you're in the Dallas area, July 19th. July 19th is the North Texas Comic Book Show. Come on by. You will see me, Cole, Bobby Blakey, Thomas Branch, Terry Parr, a lot of us cool cats who are in the comic book scene will be there.
And you will see a brand new PJ Dunn will be out there, I believe, selling his wares, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Uh-huh.
Who is about to become, he'll soon be joining the JCU with Do It Yourself, a new show all about how a lot of movies could have been done better if PJ and his guests had made them instead.
Nice.
That's right. I'm really looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to that. And I think Cole is at 10 o'clock up. No, 11 o'clock by the pool. We'll be doing a live recording called, it's going to be a JCU live recording of Comics Are For Everyone. And it's going to be myself, Cole, and Taffeta Darling.
Nice.
And we'll
And get this.
Uh-huh.
Mike Grell.
Yeah.
Green Arrow.
Yeah.
Legend Mike Grell will be a guest of this show.
Wow, that is amazing.
Really? Yes,
I did not
indeed.
Know that.
Longbow Hunter, Mike Grell.
This is at the DoubleTree Hotel, Dallas Market Center in Dallas. Go to comicbooksdallas.com and you can get all the details and see some lovely photos from past shows. And
if you want to know what other conventions are in the area.
Yes, if you're in the Dallas area or you're in Texas, you want to know, like, what conventions can I go to in Texas this year? And later on, you can find out about next year. Go to Convention Awareness Project Texas at conventionawarenesstx.blogspot.com.
So we interrupted Eddie's plugs. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I mean, I think by now people know where to find me, so it's cool.
Right. The same place. Find Eddie the same place you found us. Find Eddie on his website. What's your website, Eddie?
EddieMedina.com.
That's hard.
As I say, if you didn't know his website, you could go to the end of any episode of the Rancor.
Right. I like the fact that everything just revolves now around the same set of plugs. We should just record one set of plugs and plug that into the end of every show.
That's right.
Pretty much.
Save ourselves the trouble of actually talking.
So outside of Captain Texas, Cole, what else do we have planned for the JCU?
Absolutely. The JCU is just going gangbusters. As I said, we will soon be premiering with PJ as soon as I can get our schedules meshing. The new show, Do It Yourself, Catherine and the Unmindable Bobby Blakey joined forces for What'd You Think? In fact, when this airs, we'll be on the cusp of the latest episode on the Monkey Trouble 26, also known as Dawn of the Planet.
That's
the
right.
And, or is that Dunstan Checks In 2?
Do we have a standing arrangement for Guardians of the Galaxy? With them,
the competition to guest on Guardians of the Galaxy, I feel, will be fierce.
Okay,
I think we're just going to have to take everybody's name and throw it in a hat and let them figure out who gets to guest on that one.
Well, are we doing our standard crossover on that one?
Oh, I stand correct. Yes, indeed. So I guess whoever they want to bring in as a guest, or we'll just say we'll throw caution to the wind. And say, yes, indeed, it will be Andrew and I. Look, Eddie, I drew our names in the
house. Hey, look at that.
Oh, there you go. Wow.
So, yes, okay. In a few weeks, you can hear Andrew and myself, Mrs. Jolly Cole, and Bobby Blakey talk about just how unexpectedly amazing Guardians of the Galaxy is. I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to give it four coon tails.
Why did it have to get racist? Why did it have to get racist over here?
That was not racist.
You could have said like Groot Corns or something like that. Is that a cereal that we can get? Groot Corns?
Coontails. Oh, man.
That was not racist.
I know it wasn't racist.
That was Daniel Bootnist.
That was Daniel Bootnist!
Oh my god!
Oh god! I still want some. I want some Groot corns. Can you go get me some Groot corns?
It's new post Groot corns.
It's right, post Groot corns.
Freshly harvested, scraped daily from the surface of Groot.
Gross.
I don't want to know what part of him
it's coming from.
That's right, Groot nuts.
Let me tell you right now, Post uses every part of the Groot.
It's definitely the Native American version of the cereal. No part is wasted.
Let's just say some parts are
but you know, they did just release the new Groot cereal, Groot's Twigs and Berries. So
I don't need to know about Groot's berries.
Come on. That's a goodie.
There's also Fruity Groot's. Honey, that's my cereal.
Oh,
Fruity Groots.
Fred's Groots.
Is it Dustin Hoffman star in that movie? Alright, until next week, Eddie, say goodnight, Eddie.
Goodnight, Eddie.
Goodnight, Eddie. Say goodnight, Cole.
Goodnight, Cole.
And goodnight, Fruity Groots. Bye, collect and enjoy comics next week. Recommended reading. Thanks so much, Eddie, for coming and joining us on the show. It was amazing.
Fruity Groots.